competition really was over clients. And the sorceress didn't have any clients except somebody that wanted a better spear or a better, when gunpowder was imported from China, a better gun or whatever. So they became the inventors and scientists and engineers. In other words, technology grew out of sorcery. Psychotherapy grew out of witchery. But what is important to point out is that the priest did in his competition in the name of evil, in the name of helping these people and to liberate them from the evil spirit that had invaded them and incidentally their own spirit. Now, just close to the turn of the 17th century, something new came into use. Oddly enough, from the sorcerer, not from the witch. Of course, remember, the witch had been pretty well eliminated by that time. If the witch should practice, she did it in a dark cave and kept out of sight. By the way, witchery is coming back into vogue. There are many, many witches around the United States. They're setting up practice, they have shingle, and they're probably damn good healers. This, again, still with this ancient belief that the source of abnormal behavior is some sort of bad fluid. Evil fluid or ill fluid, ill spirit. But now the sorceress came up with an idea which we were later to call magnetism, which is the attraction of one substance to another. Well, now, think about it. If you can get a magnet, you can pull the bad juice out of the flesh, can't you? If you had a special kind of magnet that would induce the flow of the expiration, the expiring of these evil spirits, if you induce it with a magnet, you don't need the gods, do you? So the idea of magnetism, or the attraction of substance to substance. Remember, this is still seen as a substance, albeit a very unsolid sort of substance. It's still seen as a substance. So magnetism came into it, and a guy named Maxwell in 1679 published some work on magnetism, animal magnetism. And he was able to cure people of all sorts of maladies, disturbances, every imaginable kind of oddness of behavior, including things like ulcers and headaches and stomach aches and hallucinations and delusions and so on. They'd come to Maxwell and he had a very, very high cure rate. People would come from all over Europe to see him. And of course, he had his apprentices and the practice of animal magnetism spread, and it disappeared. It went out of sight by the turn of the century, or very, I'd say by 1720, it was pretty well hidden. Because when you start doing things like that, the authorities in the village get after you, throw you in jail, stuff like that. So the practice of animal magnetism was surfaced and was widely practiced, spread throughout Europe, and then disappeared. Yes?
Why did they get rid of it? I mean, it was true.
Because the authorities didn't like it. Just like witchery was a very curative practice, but the authorities didn't like it. In fact, they didn't like it so much they would kill the person who did it. At least the animal magnetists didn't get killed. They would be ridden out of town on a rail or flogged or something like that. They didn't kill them. And they were males. And it's okay to kill females, but it's not okay to kill males. We all agree on that, I trust. Now, okay, it disappeared. Now, you're going to notice that this thing, first called animal magnetism, later on called hypnosis, disappears every century. So like a stream going underground, and it'll show up. It comes up out of the ground all of a sudden 30, 40 years later. Darndest thing you ever saw. Okay, in the latter part of the 18th century, a physician called Anton Mesmer picked up Maxwell's writings and started practicing magnetism again with fantastic success. Just fabulous success. The guy was a very, very brilliant, gifted physician. And he invented countless ways. He repeated Maxwell's procedures, which included, by the way, putting a person in a bathtub and putting all kinds of metals around them, and you make some funny sounds and passes, not unlike the priest or the shaman. Take your pick. And these incantations and the metals would theoretically draw the evil fluids out of the person, and he would be well. Arise, you are healed. And he healed people. His fame spread throughout Europe. People again would come to him as they came to Lourdes later on, or earlier, for miraculous healing. He did miraculous healing. And, this was in Germany, and pretty quickly the authorities got after him. They didn't like this strange proceedings and started vilifying him, calling him names, threw him in jail, had a trial. He was not convicted of whatever it is they were accusing him of. But after that, he got angry at the Germans and split, went to Paris, and set up practice. Yes?
Who were the authorities protecting him? What was the...
the other physicians.
Okay.
The physicians, by that time, you see, they had physicians and called them that, although that's Greek. So they would get the law after their colleague who was doing things he hadn't ought or should do. And, they put him on trial. But so he went to Paris, and then his fame really spread throughout the world, and people came from all over the world to study what he's doing. They came to him for healing, strangely, by 1780, the practice of magnetizing disappeared. But he had influenced a lot of people. So it was there, but just disappeared, went underground again. In 1787, a Frenchman who was a magnetizer, who had been very heavily influenced by Mesmer, a guy named Puységur, a physician, came up with this idea. He said, what we have really here is not animal spirits being magnetically attracted to something, but we have somnambulism. Fabulous idea. Complete revolution. In the history of psychopathology, that was a major revolution. Now, he was explaining what was happening. These people, somnos, that means the same thing as our word sleep. That's Greek for sleep. And ambulism, which is, I'm not sure whether it's Greek or Latin, probably Latin, although Buell is will, but it's we say walk, sleepwalk. This person is walking in his sleep. The idea stuck and had wide influence on healers. Notice now that the treatment, not the madness, is called somnambulism. That the way to cure a person of his madness, whatever it is, bad juices or whatever, is to get him to walk in his sleep. That actually, that was probably a bad choice of word, not walk. You should have used the word do something while you were asleep. So the solution now, the therapeutic solution for most kinds of odd behaviors, including physical disabilities, was to induce sleeping behavior. Behavior while you're asleep. Fabulous idea. Now, about the middle of the century, now that we're up to the 19th century, about the middle of this, an American physician named Quimby, was over in Europe, and he picked up the practice of the inducing of somnambulism. Then, see, the animal magnetism had gone out with the 18th century. Now, when it was picked up again in the 19th century, when people started doing it again, around the middle of the 19th century, Quimby got interested in it, and he practiced inducing somnambulism. Then he came over to the United States and was giving a lecture on his idea, and noted well he said that illness, the reason people do odd things, including get sick of their stomach or have ulcers or any other thing, even warts, is because they have a bad belief. Now, he did not mean that the belief was bad, but he believed that the person got sick because he believed in sickness. He believed in illness. It was the belief that brought the illness about. Therefore, reasoned Quimby, the solution to believing in illness is to exhort. Exhort the person to give up their belief in illness. To believe, on the contrary, that illness does not exist. There is no such thing as illness, only the belief thereof. Get rid of the belief, get rid of the illness. Yeah. something wrong with your arm. There is something wrong with the arm because you believe there is. Very interesting idea. Well, he was lecturing, and in the audience was a lady that came to be known as Mary Baker Eddy, who was a paralyzed, wheelchair-ridden INFJ, who had been in a wheelchair for many, many years. I think she was about 40 when Quimby came through her town, somewhere in New England, I've forgotten where. After listening to his lecture, she got up and walked. Clearly a miraculous healing. Here was a person who had been paralyzed for so long, got up out of her chair and walked. And she became a disciple of Quimby, learned everything that he had to teach, became, so to speak, his right-hand man, did everything for him, studied with him, listened to him, served him in every way she could, arranged for his lectures and so on and so forth, and had him train her in his techniques, but especially his ideas. And when he died, which was not too long after he met Eddie, Mary Baker Eddy, she took his book, the title of which became Science and Health, probably the most influential book in the world, second only to the Bible, today. She took that idea. Illness is only an idea. Illness is not real. Only good is real. Good is God. God is good, and only God, therefore, is real. Illness is not real. And she trained thousands and thousands of practitioners who went throughout North America, South America, and Europe, and practiced what is called Christian Science. She became a multimillionaire because she was an incredibly capable administrator. She kept absolute control of that organization until the day she died. An unbelievably brilliant administrator. And she ruled that with an iron fist. Anybody that got out of line got bonked on the beam. If they got out of line with anything she said or wanted, they had it. There's probably more Christian Science, what do you call them, parishioners, disciples, today than there were in her time, and there were thousands then. There must be millions of Christian Science practitioners, disciples, and thousands of practitioners still today. Do not doubt but what they have a good track record in healing. Remember what I said at the outset. Doesn't seem to make much difference what you think is the matter with these people. And it doesn't seem to make a hell of a lot of difference what you're doing. It seems to work, including Christian Science practicing. By the way, if you want to read about Mary Baker Eddy et al. And Quimby, you must read a very long essay by Mark Twain, Samuel L. Clemens, who was treated in Europe when he had something wrong with him by a German practitioner, and given a big bill, and they never saw the guy, got teed him off, so the guy was practicing at a distance, you see. Got teed him off, so he investigated Mary Baker Eddy and her company, and wrote a rather slightly sarcastic account of Christian Science and Mary Baker Eddy. Pierre Janet, the great French psychiatrist of the turn of the century, also reported at length on Quimby and the, in fact, this is where I get my information about the history of pathology and healing, is from Pierre Janet, mainly. He traced the whole history of healing and psychopathology in his book, Volume 1 of Psychological Healing. I think it's just titled Mary Baker Eddy. I'm not sure. It's been a while since I looked at it. But Janet is looking at it objectively, and he's trying to understand what happened, why this was so, why the practice of somnambulism and animal magnetism became the base for Christian Science, and why that was so successful around the world. He's trying to understand that, trying to understand healing and pathology at once. Incidentally, Mary Baker Eddy did not credit Quimby with anything, including the writing of his own book. She put her name on it and published it. Made millions on it. And that was Mark Twain's major objective, was to show that her writings, things that she clearly wrote herself, bore no resemblance whatsoever to Quimby's book, which was clearly two different people wrote them. Now, Bertrand in 1820, thereabouts. Now we go to France in the 19th century, where Quimby got his lore and transported it to America. And a new idea was suggested. Namely, the idea of suggestion. You see the resemblance between the idea of suggestion and the idea of a bad belief. And this is how Quimby came to his conclusion that it was the having the idea of illness that created the illness. And later on we're going to see this same idea in Georg Grudek, buddy of Freud's, with this essentially the same idea, way late in the 19th century and up into the 20th century. The book, by the way, you should all read it someday, The Book of the It. Fabulous work, completely ignored by psychiatry. I don't know why. Anyway, now madness results from the person getting what Pierre Janet called a fixed idea and an unconscious idea. That it isn't that the person has a bug or bad juice or anything else. It's he's got a suggestion inside him, implanted somehow. The suggestion of illness, and therefore he's acting like an ill person acts because of the suggestion. And here we have exhort, and we have exorcism as the The first method was magic of treatment. The second method was exorcism. The third method was exhorting. And the fourth method was, guess what? Suggestion. The way to get rid of a suggestion is to give a counter suggestion. That is to say, you get the person, and by this time, this Latin expression, somnambulism, had turned to Greek hypnos, which is also sleep. Now we were calling it hypnotism. That is to say, lots of sleep. That now that the physician, the healer, in order to counter this suggestion, which has created the madness, implants a suggestion when the person isn't looking. That is to say, this is an unconscious fixed idea. Now we fix that unconscious fixed idea with a counter unconscious fixed idea. Nothing like Quimby's exhortation here, where you lecture them, saying, "Well, you're wrong to think that there's such a thing as evil exists." Big long lecture. Here now, the physician puts you in a trance and tells you that you're going to get better. A guy named Kue. Every day in every way, I'm getting better and better. Chant. But then now the physician became a counter-suggester. Again, with the really marvelous cure rate, so that we had most of the French physicians getting in on the act during the 19th century. And reporting, now they're reporting their findings in journals. In the 19th century, the scientific revolution and industrial revolution, people were writing down their experiences and repeating almost word for word, procedure by procedure, what had happened in the previous century under the name of animal magnetism. Now we call it, it was called hypnotism. But again, very, very successful practice. James Braid, a surgeon in the early part of the 19th century, before anesthetics were developed, before laughing gas was developed, ether, learned how to hypnotize his surgical patients, put them in a trance, cut their leg off, and then tell them while they're in a trance that they're going to wake up after the surgery feeling fine, comfortable, relaxed, and there would be no ill effects and they were just going to be fine. His cure rate, now I'm talking about cutting the flesh. At that time, in the early part of the 19th century, the death rate from almost any kind of surgery was about 80%. Only 20% survived because of two things. One, shock, and the other, sepsis, that is, infection. They didn't know that you had to wash your hands and that there were germs everywhere, in the air, everywhere. So they'd do what they do their surgery and wash their instruments in a bucket that was from the previous surgery. You know, they'd spread all the diseases through every patient in the surgical ward, and of course most of them died. Only the hardiest could survive, but a major operation like cutting a leg off or something, that person was doomed if he went to a surgeon. Braid's cure rate went up to 80%, so that he only lost 20% of his patients. Do you think that the other surgeons appreciated him and applauded him for this? They damn near rid him out of town on the rail. They persecuted him, vilified him, brought him to trial for such strange practices. But this tells you something about the marvelous properties of the procedure of using suggestion, implanting an idea to counter the other idea that supposedly is fixed there. Of course, in the case of surgery, there's no such fixed idea except the person's pessimism. But again, his patients would heal up faster and were able to ward off sepsis by suggestion alone. And I say that's a magnificent achievement. He wasn't the only one. There was another guy, Esdale, in India, doing the same thing. And he was vilified too. Okay. They did. Oh, the other doctors? I don't know. I think people in the sciences, whatever that, you know, technical people, are extremely parochial and inflexible and vicious with respect to their colleagues. So that almost every invention throughout the history of man has been greeted with derision and vilification and sometimes even lawsuits. And that goes for the first introduction of the use of nitrous oxide as an anesthetic. The guy that did it was practically thrown out of France or England and vilified, and they almost brought him to trial for it. So innovations in healing practice have almost invariably been greeted with derision and lawsuits, not with applause. Let me bring us up to the 20th century rather quickly, and then we can take a break. In 1880, thereabouts, a French I think it was a neurologist, Charcot, who was the director of the hospital there, Salpêtre, revived the practice of hypnosis. It had gone underground by that time, and for a very brief time, about 10 years, the French started doing it again, and now they were experimenting with it, making very careful observations. Charcot was clearly an upstanding scientist, and he made very careful observations, and there were two warring schools about who would, the Nancy School and the Salpêtre School, arguing about what's going on here. Bernheim in his school won the argument, which was in favor of the idea of suggestion, whereas Charcot was trying to say, well, it's hysteria that is the occasion for this strange behavior that called hypnosis. You have to be an hysteric to do it. Bernheim showed that this was not the case at all, won the argument. Now, in Germany, in the early 70s, some German physicians had been put into the then new booby hatches. They were called asylums. What they were jails where nuts were put. People that were acting crazy, they'd throw them into the booby hatch, lock them up. And here were these German physicians, had the foggiest idea what to do with these people. They had no training at all in suggestion or hypnosis or somnambulism or trance. They didn't even know about that. Here they were with their white coats and all, and all these nuts tooling around saying crazy things and doing every imaginable crazy thing that they could think of now that they were in the booby hatch. So the first of these was a guy named Hecker. And he said, well, what they did, they would just watch him. Now and then they'd put him in a straitjacket, throw him in a solitary confinement. They'd watch him and they'd take notes of what they did. Very careful notes, beautiful notes. But they wanted to be scientific. After all, this is in the wake of the scientific revolution, and so they started giving these people names. Hecker said, well, now these people are hebephrenics. Hebe, youth, phrenic. Hebephrenia. It roughly, hebe or hebe is Greek for youth or young, youthful. And I won't translate phrenia. It's been translated so many ways. I'll just call it frenzy, which is, it's anglicized. It's the same word. It's a Greek word, frenzy. And we use it more or less meaningfully now, the word frenzy, or frantic, or frenetic. Actually, the translation of phrenia is that it's the midriff, the heart region. That's probably why, I don't know why he picked that term, but he did. Youthful frenzy or franticness. His superior, Kalbaum, another Kraut physician in the same booby hatch, I guess he didn't want to be outdone. He was also with his white coat studying these people, and he wanted to be scientific too, and he didn't know how to help them. So he says, well, the ones I've been watching are catatonics, catatonia. And so we had hebephrenia and catatonia. So this is the beginning of the classifiers of mental illness. Now we have the DSM. It came straight from these German physicians that had no healing skills and were put in charge of the people that were acting frantic. Well, he says catatonia. Now that kata is down, and tonia, well, you can take it straight, toned down. And because these people would go into stupors, you know, with their eyes rolled up in their head or in crazy positions. And he says, well, that's really weirdo stuff. It's the opposite of frenzy. It's the opposite of being frantic. So I'm going to call them toned down people. Only, you see, you aren't scientific unless you use Greek, so he used Greek. Then along came Kreplin, Emil Kreplin. He was a professor at University of Berlin, I think, one of those German cities, and he also had the hospital of the university. He was in charge of it. And he was going to put psychiatry in order. Things will be orderly around here. Yeah. Yeah. So he looked at all this stuff and he wrote his first version of the textbook. The textbook of psychiatry. It went into 9 revisions. He rewrote it. He said, well now, what we really have here is dementia praecox. Well, now, if that's Latin, for hyperphenia. Dementia, day without. Mentia, mind without mind early. Early without mind. Same thing as hyperphenia. But, you know, he didn't want to be outdone by Hecker and Kalbaum, so he threw in a little Latin here to help things along. And he said, well, on the one hand, there's dementia praecox, and then on the other, there is dementia paranoidis, dementia paranoidis. And then there is manic depressive psychosis. And he says, these things that Hecker and Kalbaum are talking about are special kinds of dementia praecox. So he subsumed these under him. He says, that's one kind of dementia praecox, and this is another kind of dementia praecox. And this is a third kind of dementia praecox, early madness. And now we have today paranoid, catatonic, and hebephrenic dementia praecox, which was later called by Carl Jung and Eugen Bleuler schizophrenia. Now, one may ask, what good does it do to talk Greek? How does that shed any light on, how does that help us understand these odd things that people do? I'm afraid the answer has to be, all it does is confuse the hell out of us. Now, one final comment about the history of mental illness up to the 20th century. Besides, so to speak, bringing the psychiatric house into order, this is the way he ordered it. He said, and there must be a bad organ behind this. If we look hard enough, we will find not bad juice, mind you, not bad spirits, not bad fluid, but a bad solid. We will find a bad organ, bad cells. I don't remember now whether the cell theory had been specifically announced by that time. I rather think it had, the cell theory of Schleiden and Zwan. But he says, now we have a bad organ, which if we look carefully enough and long enough, we will find that bad organ. And that is why people do crazy things, because they get a bad organ that's getting them to do it. Do you think that idea has gone away? That idea, along with the bad juice theory, still very much with us, more so in 1980 than it was in 1950. I mean, it has come back with a vengeance. Now we have the right brain has gotten out of hand. It is now dominating the person, has taken over the person. And we have a bunch of right-brain persons doing bad things because the right brain has somehow taken over. Of course, in the 50s, it was the reticular formation in the brainstem. And then later on, it was the limbic formation, the old nose brain. Sooner or later, every piece of tissue in the brain has been cited as the source of mad behavior. In other words, it's a bad organ that's getting people to do bad stuff. Let me sum it up this way and say all of the old ideas about madness are still very much with us. They have not gone away. Have the therapeutic practices that went along with these notions gone away? No, sir, and no, ma'am. Do you know that they're resurrecting leucotomy and lobotomy, not to mention shock therapies of all kinds, metrazole, electroshock,